hea o ko e ko ka aha. I nā he kuiana i mua o kea aha ho kolo kolo ki e ke hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nāo mai, e malio mai, i lohi ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh, give your attention, and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Case number SCWC-16-4, State of Hawaii versus Michael Abella. Arguing for the petitioner, Dana Ishibashi. Arguing for the respondent, Chad Kumagai. Argument on the merits.
The court. This case, I believe, is about attributing responsibility for the death of Shelton Higa. Did Michael Abella cause the death of Shelton Higa, or did he contribute to the creation of a substantial risk of death? Now, there's a conflict when we looked at the briefs in this case between a general broad-reaching statute, namely the causation statutes in the penal code, and the particular statutes arising out of the Health Care Decisions Act and surrounding the statute defining death and how death is pronounced. But first, I want to go through a little bit of the facts of this case. Just very generally, on July 17, 2014, Mr. Abella assaulted Shelton Higa. He was arrested on that day. Mr. Higa identified him as the person who assaulted him. Mr. Higa was transported to Queens Medical Center. At that point, he was conscious from the assault when he was taken to the hospital, and they needed a CAT scan at that point. So he was, his movement was not really secured in terms of he wasn't able to really stay very still, which you need to do to take the CAT scan. So they decided to sedate him. Now, when they did that, they induced a coma in Mr. Higa. They put him on a ventilator, and they submitted him to the CAT scan. He looked at it. They said, okay, you need some surgery, a craniotomy to relieve the stress on the brain. They did that, and it was successful according to the doctor. Now, I'm going to note that the doctor on cross-examination acknowledged improvements in Mr. Higa's medical status. On July 20th, 2014, slight eye opening indicating a slight bit of consciousness. On the next day, the 21st, he responded to a rub of the sternum. On the following day, July 22nd, 2014, his eyes opened briefly, blinking to threats, which showed slight improvement in consciousness. They applied a noxious stimuli to his feet and left side and indicated movement, which was purposeful and as opposed to N or reflexive. 2 days later, July 24th, he clearly localized with his left arm, which indicated little gradations of consciousness. Localizing the sternum, he was able to localize where the stimulus was coming from and actually reach toward that movement. On the 27th, his daughter was notified. His daughter was an RN at Queens itself. So about a week after this person was admitted to the hospital, his daughter was discovered working there. On the 28th, he opens his eyes at the hearing of a voice, and he was stable. He was not worsening. Dr. Oshiro testified that in his professional opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that it was possible that Mr. Higa could regain independent breathing more likely than not. He basically said there's no telling where the improvements were going to stop.
Explain that. A reasonable degree of medical certainty, there was a possibility he could be regain breathing.
That's
more
what the
probable
doctor,
than not.
That's what the doctor agreed on.
Well, how do you interpret that?
I interpret that there was a chance that this guy was improving.
Okay, so it's more of a
possibility. His health was getting better. That's how I interpret it. I mean, this is only, 10 days after the surgery, basically.
But you're still calling it, you think it's a possibility?
Right.
Okay.
And
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Shibashi, but you talked about the participation of the daughter. And can you explain the extent to which the record reflects that she had knowledge of the improvement, improvement that you've been describing?
I'm getting there, right. She was not told of the improvements. I asked her at trial, I went through all of these dates and all of the things that the doctors and the staff there noted in the record. And she said that she was not informed of any of it. But she decided, because she saw him sitting there or laying there, and she reflected back saying that, remember when either an aunt or her mother or somebody was in that same situation, and she went to visit her father, and she says her father said, I don't want to live like that. Okay, so in that case, she used that justification to say she is going to pull the plug.
But does the record reflect any dispute as to whether there was improvement preceding the time that the daughter decided for life support to be ended?
Well, there was another doctor involved, Steinman. And she testified that she basically didn't go and see him every day. As Dr. Oshiro had gone to see this person every day. And
Mr. Ishibashi, aren't we dealing with legal issues primarily in this case? I understand the facts. I think the court does as well. And it's complicated, and there's,
All right. I'm getting to that.
What did the court do wrong?
All right. At judgment of acquittal time, I move for judgment of acquittal. And I cited Section 327C1 and also 327E13. Now, the Intermediate Court of Appeals said, the 327E statute is merely a decision-making for healthcare type statute, and it has no relationship to whether a defendant should be benefiting by the language in subsection E13, which basically says it shall, death resulting in withholding or withdrawal shall not for any purpose constitute a homicide. Now, in 327C1 defines death. Now, it defines death as the cessation of spontaneous respiratory and circulatory functions. Now, that's subsection A. Subsection B talks about if artificial means of support preclude that determination, then they need two physicians, generally saying, to determine that irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem, has occurred. Now, when you go further into that statute, it says all death determinations in the state shall be made pursuant to this section and shall apply to all purposes, including criminal actions. Now, this second section, subsection B, goes directly to answering that question that the intermediate court did not answer. That is, that this subsection 13 and 327E, in fact, does apply because it basically goes to the subsection B in C1, which is artificial means of support and the withdrawal thereof.
Okay. Is there any history at all to indicate that the legislature intended the provisions in 327E to address culpability for actors who may have put the person in the situation of needing this decision to be made?
No, but there is some indication by what they did in 327E9, that is the immunity section of that surrogate decision-making process, basically holding healthcare providers or institutions acting in good faith shall not be subject to civil or criminal liability. So using that as here's the legislature sitting there deciding, well, what are we going to do and why do we have this language? We know what homicide means, and in fact, murder is like homicide, right?
Client is not being charged with a homicide resulting from the withdrawal of health care.
No.
Your client is being charged and prosecuted for his actions that had nothing to do with health care.
Right.
And the statute says death resulting from withdrawal, withholding or withdrawal of health care. I don't see how your statute on its face, how your client on its face comes within the parameters of the provision.
All it says, the statute says, is the death, and we're talking death. And that's what my client was charged with originally, is causing the death.
But not death resulting from the absence of health care.
Well, death is death, and death got to be answered with the use of the statute, 327C1. That's what this statute says.
Where was, is there an instruction? Did the court instruct on what death meant?
No.
There's no instruction on death?
Well, following up on Justice McKenna's point, let's assume that the statute addresses death that's caused by the withdrawal of artificial life support. So, from your point of view, technically, that's what happened here, right? Okay. What kind of instruction would you have wanted? What did you expect the instruction to say?
Well, I would suppose that portions of this statute would be included.
Yes.
Do you have a suggestion? Included.
Okay.
The death by artificial means would be included. The purpose of, in terms of all death determination, shall be made, including criminal action, shall be made in this regard.
See, I thought your argument, as I understood it, was that the court erred in for judgment of acquittal, because as a matter of law under the statute, he cannot be prosecuted for what happened here pursuant to 327E or would protect him. That was one thing. The other issue I understood you were raising is the lack of instruction regarding, I'll call it intervening causation, but not just a but-for instruction which the court gave, but an instruction that would have the jury address the subsequent actions that took place. Now I'm hearing you argue.
No, I think it's basically all consistent, cause of death and the way in which death is occurred in this case, and that they needed to consider the statutes and what the law says regarding how a person dies and, under what circumstance. The other things that the statute provides for is that these acts that are conducted by healthcare providers and the person ultimately, the surrogate who ultimately authorizes the pulling of the plug, should include a written statement sworn to under perjury of law, and it should be included in the medical records. This was not done. No evidence was that we don't know that, in fact, the process was followed.
Okay, well, then perhaps what you're raising, there could be potential liability of the people at the hospital, but it has nothing really to do with your client.
I understand that, but all I'm suggesting here is that when a person is determined to be dead in, under the circumstance of the statute, that statute says shall not for any purpose. That includes everything, including an indictment by the grand jury, shall not constitute a homicide.
So in other words, the daughter and the physicians are not liable.
Well, yeah, and still, and my client as well, because he had nothing to do with that.
But you acknowledge there's no legislative history to indicate that's the, what the legislature intended, as opposed to addressing issues related to the folks in the hospital who are making decisions.
I would agree with that, but I would suggest to the court that they didn't just sit there and waive their discussion on this issue. They determined under subsection E9 that certain people would be immune. And so they sat there and they discussed immunities. And they didn't include the surrogate decision maker in that immunity section. They basically gave immunity to healthcare providers and institutions.
So how does that help your client?
Not the they didn't do it for anyone else.
Yeah, but how does that affect, how does that help you? It's an argument.
It says that what it does is it tells you that they discussed this issue. And if they wanted to explicitly say that it doesn't absolve a person like my client in whose shoes that he was in, and they knew what they were talking about because they're talking about homicide. They know. No, and they include criminal actions in this language in these statutes.
Mr. Ishibashi, the Chief Justice mentioned two arguments. Perhaps it might be, perhaps you should consider moving on to the next question.
The intervening causation of the instruction. I believe you're saying there was an error by the court in not instructing, and I'm referring to it as intervening causation, but I think the statutory citations that you had referred to were 702, 15, and 16, that there should have been an instruction given to have the jury decide whether in these cases the outcome was too dependent on another's volitional conduct to have a bearing on the defendant's liability or gravity of the offense. Could you address that?
That's a causation statute. And,
I think this might be the culpability statute, as opposed to the causation statute 702.214. And specifically with respect to that statute that the Chief Justice addressed, asked you to address your attention to, let me ask you if you could, and since you've been talking about judgment of acquittal, help me with this concept of have a bearing. The definition of recklessness with respect to 216 suggests that if the volitional conduct of another has a bearing on the defendant's liability. So from the point of view of the facts in this case, is there any factual dispute as to whether or not the actions of the daughter had a bearing on the defendant's liability? In other words, a bearing on whether the decedent in this case actually was going to die?
Well, if she didn't pull the plug, he wouldn't have died right at that point. The doctor testified.
So is it your view that the record is clear that her actions had a bearing on the defendant's liability or on the gravity of...
had an effect because then they charged him with murder.
And to what extent, then, would that be relevant, if at all, to a judgment of acquittal?
Well, I would basically suggest that, you know, but for her pulling the plug, that guy might have still been alive at the time of the trial.
So why wasn't there a motion for judgment of acquittal on that basis?
Well, when I raised it, that's basically what I was saying. That, you know, he's not to be held responsible for that. Basically, and that's the plain reading of 327E13, basically, that doesn't qualify anybody, but the chapter gives immunities to only certain people, but it doesn't exclude anyone from that statute about for any purpose shall not be considered a homicide. So in other words, he shouldn't have been charged with a homicide in the beginning or murder. That's fundamentally what I asked for. He shouldn't have been charged with murder. Maybe, and now at this point, we look at it and we say, okay, well, maybe he was culpable at least of assault in the first degree, maybe.
Mr. Ishibashi, your argument during trial was causation, and there was an intervening act.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's what you were consistent in your argument, and now you're saying it was plain error for the court not to include an intervening act causation instruction.
Well,
why didn't you?
I'm basically saying that that's connected to the fact that she denied the motion, and once she did that, that was it. It cleared the deck of that issue. She didn't want to put it forward, so she's not going to.
I'm not sure what I understand by you saying it cleared the deck. Are you wholly putting aside the denial of the motion for judgment of acquittal? Are you arguing the court erroneously instructed the jury? That was my understanding.
Well, I'm thinking that she at least could have included a jury instruction to discuss this issue.
Why didn't you propose one? Well, that was your argument.
The way in which this person died, and whether or not my client is actually responsible when there is something like all the 12 days of hospitalization and the care, and really consider that issue closely and instead of just a very broad general causation. Well, caused the death, and they found that his acts were reckless, and so they convicted him of manslaughter. So, I mean,
don't you?
She could have done it. She could have gave an instruction, but she didn't.
But Mr. Ishibashi, why didn't you submit an instruction on an intervening causation instruction? Why didn't you submit a proposed instruction on that? Because that was your argument all along.
Right. Yeah, I have no excuse for
that. Well, then, your position is it could be considered plain error. Is that right?
Right.
And how would you define plain error with respect to these facts? Why would this constitute plain error? To what extent do you think it makes a difference?
She had knowledge of all of the facts on the record at that time, including the way in which Mr. Higa they withheld the ventilator from him, including all of that. She had all of the evidence of all the improvements and the testimony of Dr. Oshiro, who said there's no telling how much the improvements.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but how do those facts relate to the issue of plain error?
Well, then you're asking that, well, okay, then there should be a jury instruction which defines this. These acts, these statutes about artificial means of support, and the withdrawal of such did that have an impact on this person's death? I would think. I don't know.
Are you suggesting it had an effect on a substantial effect on the rights of your client?
Well, got convicted of causing the death, basically recklessly. So yeah.
Anything further on this issue related to the lack of instruction on intervening causation?
No. I think basically there's no legislative history regarding this issue. The state points to 327D14, which was repealed. It was repealed at the time, so I don't think you can use a statute after it's been repealed. And I think when you repeal it, you're repealing also the history of that statute.
But then again, there's no law saying that you can't look at it. The other thing is the question of withdrawing life support. They claim that it's not an independent intervening cause of death, but the cases that they cite are all cases where, in fact, the decedent is in a vegetative state, not improving in terms of health, or there's some cases where they're not even defined in the history of the or the facts of the case. So mainly the cases that are cited, the facts are extreme, and they're not like this case in terms of where the facts show that the person who ultimately died was in fact improving in his health.
Your position is the jury should have been asked to, in those circumstances, to decide and given an instruction under 702.215.016. Those statutes talk about whether the actual result involves the same kind of injury or harm, is not too remote or accidental, I'm paraphrasing here, or too dependent on another's volitional conduct to have a bearing on the defendant's liability or on the gravity of the defendant's offense. So is it your position that that was a jury question to decide, whether in this circumstance the volitional conduct of the folks at the hospital arguably had a bearing on the defendant's liability? Is that what you're arguing?
That's part of it. I think at the point the judge should have decided that at the time of the question of the motion for judgment of acquittal, and she could have just ended it right there. But not having done that, she could have submitted.
As a matter of law, the judge should have said that. That's what your position is, as a matter of law, the judge should have said no case, right? But putting that aside, what about the jury instruction issue?
Yeah, well, putting that aside, then if she knows about it, then she could have submitted it to the jury as an instruction to determine the facts of the case under that circumstance.
But wait a minute, you're talking about the 327E. Is that what you're talking about, the instruction on that? Because that's a matter of law. And she's not going to instruct the jury to juries don't decide matters of law. Are you talking about the 327E or the causation instruction?
I'm talking that she should have submitted this question. See, these are 327E is a decision making process of when a person can withhold. Well, one of the things is when a person can withhold artificial life support, and I think that is part of something that the jury should have considered.
So you don't think the 214 causation instructions?
I think it's all part and parcel of the same, but I think that these statutes are more particularized in their application of this problem of determining when death or how and when death occurs.
So specifically, in response to Justice Nakayama, you are suggesting that an instruction based on 702.216 would have been required that would allow the jury to determine whether or not the conduct of the daughter had a bearing on the death of the defendant. Is that right?
That's part and parcel of the whole process.
Very well. Anything further at this time, or do you want to reserve your time for rebuttal?
I'll do that. I'll reserve this.
We'll hear from Mr. Kumabai.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Chad Kumagai for the State. Your Honors, by my count, there are 20 states in the District of Columbia who have been confronted with the exact same issue before the court, whether life support constitutes an intervening cause in a homicide prosecution. All of those courts have unanimously said that withholding life support is not an intervening cause.
How many of those 20 states have the same statutes that we do? And I'm specifically referring to 215 and 216.
That I can't say, Justice Pollack. I'm not aware. But I do know that at least in North Carolina, there's a very similar statute to the one that Mr. Ishibashi just referenced, 327E-13.
Okay. Yeah, I understand.
Thank you. So, Your Honors, based on those lines of cases, the court should similarly hold that when a person is removed from life support, that in of itself is not an intervening cause. Instead, withholding life support merely allows the affliction caused by the defendant to take its natural course, which in this case was death.
Go ahead.
Wasn't there a dispute as to what the natural, at least based on the evidence, there seems to have been a difference of an opinion in the experts, or you could infer a difference in opinion as to what the natural result might have been. But I really want to focus on 702, 215, and 216 also.
Yes, sir.
And isn't there a question as to whether or not the death was too dependent on another's volitional conduct to have a bearing on the defendant's liability or on the gravity of the defendant's offense? That language, my understanding is, only appears in two states, Hawaii and New Jersey.
Well, first,
so all those other cases, jurisdictions that you cite, don't have this provision.
Well, first I would note that 702.216, the way it reads, reading the statute in its entirety, it appears that the statute allows the imposition of criminal liability under certain circumstances, so long as
But the problem was the jury wasn't instructed on this.
Well, I disagree with that, Justice McKenna. The jury was instructed as to the 702.214.
That's but four.
I'm sorry?
That's but four. This is intervening or potential superseding or even mitigating.
Well, yes.
Or more specifically, but four. How would you compare the standard of but four to just having a bearing? In other words, isn't it likely that you could have a determination by a jury that certainly as a result of the actions of a defendant there was a death, because but for the actions of the defendant, say, for example, in an assault case where somebody is punched and they fall down and they die. But in a situation like that where the individual goes to the hospital and is getting better and medical malpractice causes them to die, it would be pretty clear under that circumstance that the actions of the doctor had a bearing on the death of the person that was improving after being involved in an assault. But your analysis is that the defendant could not resort to just having a bearing standard. They're just stuck with this idea of but for the assault, the injury wouldn't have occurred. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct, Justice Wilson. The jury was free to consider the intervening cause that Mr. Ishibashi mentioned.
But not under the standard of just having a bearing. The standard they applied was but for, unless I'm missing something. Well, isn't that much significantly different?
Well, if there was an independent third party who committed a volitional act that disrupted the chain of events in this case, the jury was free to consider that.
How did the jury know that when it wasn't so instructed?
Because it was instructed on the 702.214, Your Honor, with the but-for.
But isn't the but-for, as long as it's antecedent, that the result would not have occurred? In other words, it wouldn't have mattered. Once the person assaulted the person, the defendant assaulted the person, that's it.
Well, if there were any evidence of medical negligence, as Justice Wilson referred to,
well, did you dispute what Mr. Ishibashi said, that there was a possibility of recovery?
I would dispute the way in which he presented it to the court. I'd like to quote Dr. Oshiro, who talked about possible versus likely. Dr. Oshiro said, I would say it was possible, but not possible to me. Possible to me means less than 50-50. Likely means more likely than not. I would say it was probably possible. That's docket 33, page 48 to 49. And so from that, it wasn't that Dr. Oshiro was saying that it was likely that he would regain consciousness, which he never did.
He said it was possible. He didn't say there was no chance, correct?
Correct. But I think, you know, anything is possible with current medical technology. So
wasn't he testifying to all his testimony, reasonable medical certainty that it was possible?
Yes, he did testify to a reasonable degree of medical certainty.
So go ahead.
No, just it's just the follow-up. It's not. It's different.
But if the definition of death is cessation of respiratory and circulatory functions, it wasn't there enough evidence there that the defendant, I mean, the victim may have, the decedent may have been able to continue breathing on his own?
If that were the case, he would have continued breathing after life support was removed.
And then is there any question about the fact that the decedent was actually improving at the time that the life support was, or is improving in the period preceding the removal of life support?
Improving in a relative sense.
If that's the case, if the improvement was taking place, is there any dispute in the record that the actions of the daughter combined with the doctors had a bearing on the death? A bearing on the defendant's liability from the point of view of the death not being exclusively attributable to the defendant?
No, Your Honor. I would disagree with that. And I would also note...
Well, I'm not sure what you're disagreeing with. I'm sorry to ask such a long question. Maybe you can just tell me, do you disagree with the proposition that the actions of the daughter had a bearing on the death?
Yes, I disagree with that.
And your position is, therefore, that the actions of the daughter didn't have any bearing on the death?
Yes. All three doctors, Dr. Steinman, Dr. Oshiro, and Dr. Happy, all testified that the cause of death was a subdural hematoma.
That's the but-for causation. Now we're talking about another inquiry here, which is the culpability inquiry. 216 would require, is there not? What's your position as to why we weren't in the ballpark, why there wasn't enough evidence to suggest that that question should have been put to the jury, given the improvement?
Well, like I said, Mr. Chief Justice, it seems from the record that the improvements were relatively small. The complainant never regained consciousness. Dr. Steinman testified that on a scale of 3 to 15, 3 being the person is basically dead, the complainant was a 5. And that was not caused by the sedation.
At the end of the 10-day period or towards the beginning? I thought that was relatively early.
That was relatively early.
Okay, so before the improvements, correct?
That's right. Okay. Well, and another thing I'd like to note that Mr. Ishibashi mentioned, Dr. Steinman also testified that the sedation for the CAT scan as well as the anesthesia for the craniotomy did not induce the coma. She testified that the drugs that were given were off in a predictable manner, and therefore it was her opinion that the coma was not caused by the medical procedures.
You know, it seems to me this whole argument is just we're taking this decision-making from the jury. We're sitting here and debating facts. That's really not our function. That's what juries are for. And it was up to them to decide under our statute what the applicability of the factors in 216.
It was, it's my position that it was up to them and it was presented to the jury by the defense. When he argued, he went through great detail what the alleged improvements were in the complainant's condition. He argued that it wasn't fair to hold his client responsible for withholding health care.
But Justice McKenna's question to you was, let's suppose the jury agreed with the defense counsel in this case. They had no law that allowed them to say, wait a minute, because of these factors in 216, we're going to find that this individual is not guilty as reckless manslaughter.
Well, certainly at the very least, they were free to find that the defendant did not cause the death. If that was caused by the health care that the complainant received after the assault, the jury was free to find that the defendant did not cause the death and acquit him of murder and manslaughter.
Well, not under the standard in 216. You are focusing on 214, but for, as opposed to this idea of whether the actions of the daughter or the medical providers had any bearing.
Not only on the defendant's liability, but also on the gravity of the defendant's offense. In other words, if the jury had been so instructed, they could have considered assault one.
And as instructed, they could have, if they didn't believe that the defendant had the intent, based on the gravity of the alleged assault, they could have found him guilty of a lesser included offense, assault one, all the way down to assault three. All of those instructions were given.
And I think if I had been the court instructing, what I might have done, and I'm not saying this is the way it should be done, but it seems to me that what the jury should have been, how they should have been instructed, is they would have been instructed to find the grade of the offense, whether it's manslaughter or assault, and at that point, when they find the elements of that particular offense, then they get the 702.216, because at that point, you give them an interrogatory and you ask them whether or not the bearing fact, and if the jury says yes, no, depending on that, that's whether or not ultimate responsibility.
I think one of the problems with giving an instruction on 702.216 is that the instruction, this issue was never raised before the trial court.
I thought it was in his closing argument that was in pretty much one of the argument points made in closing.
It was argued by the defense, but there was no request by the defense to include a 216 instruction prior to instructing the jury.
Our case law is pretty clear, though. In criminal cases, it really is the judge's obligation to properly instruct.
That's correct.
When there's credible evidence of a defense.
That's correct.
Or the mitigating factor.
But the way that the statute reads, reading the entire statute, not just subsection 2, the statute reads to impose liability where there wasn't, for lack of a better term, an intervening cause.
Let me ask you this. What if Mr. Higa's condition improved to the point where it appeared he was consciously attempting to pull his respirator out of his mouth? So he appears to have an awareness of his circumstances, appears to be trying to do something about it. He had that level of consciousness and awareness, and if his daughter made the decision, then you know what? My dad just would not have wanted to live this way. Would we give the jury instruction then?
I think if there were evidence of that the complainant was successful in pulling out the breathing
test. It doesn't matter whether he's successful or not. A further level of consciousness beyond what was manifested. So I'm trying to figure out how far, I guess you're arguing as a matter of law, there wasn't enough here to give the instruction. I'm trying to understand from your position how far that principle goes.
Well, I think
would you agree with me or not? You know, 5 days later, she didn't make the call on 28th, she let it go for a while longer. When they come in to see him, he's pulling at the respirator. He's trying to get that thing out of his mouth in a way that suggests he knew what he was doing. He didn't want to be in this situation. So at that point, would we give the instruction? Because maybe there's enough of a thought that he might be on his way to recovery.
No, Your Honor. Not if the complainant subsequently passed away after the breathing apparatus was taken out.
And then stopped speaking.
Your Honor, that still
wouldn't give the instruction.
No, because that still doesn't indicate that he could have survived the results of the assault.
Was there testimony that there is beyond that, based upon a reasonable medical certainty, his condition could not have continued to improve?
The closest testimony there was in the record is that it was unlikely that the complainant would be able to breathe on his own again.
Well, let's assume that's the state of the record, that it's clear that he was improving. It's clear that he may well have been able to continue to live if he'd been on life support. In other words, he couldn't have survived without breathing, but with the breathing, the doctors are comfortable he would continue to live. And that, therefore, we find that judgment of acquittal should have been granted, because there's no question under this record that the actions of the daughter had a bearing on his death. Then, let's just making that assumption, should we reverse, or is this case to be remanded for trial on offenses other than manslaughter?
Well, the conviction should be affirmed, first of all.
Well, I can see this is an uncomfortable scenario for you, and you'd rather not assume that we would find that there is not a basis for affirming the manslaughter. But let's assume not only do we find that there's not a basis, but that there isn't sufficient evidence to show that the actions of the daughter didn't have a bearing on it, and therefore judgment of acquittal should have been granted. So is that it? Is the whole case reversed, or are there remaining offenses to be tried on remand?
Well, no, Justice Wilson, Mr. Ishibashi has framed the issue before this court as instructional error with respect to that particular issue. You know, he raised the 327E-13 in his judgment of acquittal, but he presents the intervening cause point of error as instructional error. So in that case, if the court doesn't agree with me, then the case should be remanded for another trial.
You know, what just occurred to me, that let's say that we had a complainant, a person that didn't have a health care directive, or whose health care directive said, do not remove life support, right? So in that situation, well, I guess death could down the line result, but let's say that this person just keeps, you know, stays breathing for many, many, many years. Yet when we have a person that does have a health care directive, the jury should not be instructed that the effect of that health care directive is not volitional conduct, that they're not instructed that there was volitional conduct that could have a bearing on the gravity or liability or gravity. I'm just starting to think, wow, it seems like there's like we're treating defendants differently based on the status of the person that they assault.
Well, Justice McKenna, I don't mean to be macabre or flippant about things, but the complainant in this case benefited from advances in medical technology. Had the ambulance not come and taken him to the hospital, he would have passed away on the street that night. And so that's all that the withdrawal of health care did. It didn't have a bearing on his death. All of the doctors said the subdural hematoma was the cause of death. And so going back to my original point, it's the state's position that there was no reason to give an instruction.
So there was medical expert testimony that actually, but for the provision of putting him on life support, he would have died.
Yes, there is. Dr. Steinman testified, at least Dr. Steinman and I believe Dr. Oshiro as well, testified that the large blood clot in his brain was creating pressure in his skull that was impinging on the base of his skull that compressed his brainstem, which affected his respiratory functioning, his cardiac functioning, and that without the emergency craniotomy, the large blood clot was deadly. That is the state of the record.
Okay.
Did I hear you say that you thought that if there were malpractice, that would be a place where this instruction should be given?
It could be.
Now, why, based on the plain language of the statute, would you look at malpractice would be something we would ask about, but not decisions about quality of life that might be made by a family member?
Because
maybe something that would be within
Because in a case of medical malpractice, there would be an independent volitional cause that disrupts the chain of events, the factual chain of events. Not only that, but the jury would be free to find, and there would be a basis to find, that the defendant did not cause the death of the complainant. Rather, the medical malpractice or negligence caused the death of the complainant. But there's simply no evidence of medical malpractice or gross negligence in this case.
Now, you're describing the importance of recognizing an intervening cause where an individual is charged with an offense as serious as homicide. Mr. Ishibashi brings up an interesting point about 327E13. It's a fairly unequivocal statute, right? It says death resulting from the withholding or withdrawal of health care shall not, for any purpose, constitute a homicide.
Well,
now, one might, on the basis of what you're arguing, suggest that when you talk about the intervention, if there is one, and in this case I don't think there's any question there was an intervention by the daughter, when you talk about an intervention, then the idea of a homicide arising from the death becomes awkward just in terms of culpability, trying to figure out how culpable a person should be as a result of another person intervening in a way that causes the death. So the argument that the legislature may have considered, which is there just doesn't seem to be, it's too complicated to try to charge somebody with a homicide after there's been a conscious decision to end the life of the decedent, is a reason just not to allow homicide to be the basis of a charge.
I'm sorry, Justice Wilson. Well,
so the question is, isn't that a basis one for which we could assume the intent of this statute is to just make it clear you can't charge a homicide after there's been a conscious intervention under 327E13, period?
Well, I would certainly disagree with that. For one, for the reasons cited by the EICA, the legislative history, but more than that, these statutes that we're talking about today, the 327 sections, can trace their roots back to the 50s and later the 60s, in which great medical advances were achieved first with the positive pressure ventilator and then with the first successful heart transplant in 1967.
Lots of ways to do interventions.
That's right. That's right. And then in 1968, there was a Harvard ad hoc committee to determine the definition of death. And from there, all of these statutes, similar to the ones that we're talking about today, were enacted across the country, starting in Kansas, then Virginia, then across the rest of the country. And the common touchstone of all of these statutory schemes is that the statute operates to protect the doctor and, I guess, the surrogate from criminal liability. Because at common law, suicide and assisted suicide were felonies. So given that legacy, it's clear that 327E-13 is meant to address doctors and surrogates' liability.
And to remove the tawdry analysis that would go along with trying to look at whether or not what the doctor did actually caused the death. There's not a but-for standard applied. The statute simply says, look, if there's been an intervention, you know, where somebody is alive and they're on life support and there's intervention to take away the life support, we're not going to go into detail about the extent to which, but for the action, the death would have occurred.
Well, first of all, this chapter has absolutely nothing to do with the penal code. So all of this but-for discussion.
Really?
I don't believe that it applies.
The decision not to charge somebody with murder doesn't have anything to do with the penal code?
Not in this case.
Oh, okay.
Right.
I thought you were saying just the statutes in general have nothing to do with the penal code. So.
Well, I'd also like to read the full sentence in 327E-13. B, death resulting from the withholding or withdrawal of health care in accordance with this chapter, I think is very important as applied to this case, because as Mr. Ishibashi mentioned, there were several things that there wasn't evidence of that's required by this statute. So, according to the plain language of the statute, even if it operates in the way that Mr. Ishibashi suggests, he cannot avail himself to the protections of this statute because there wasn't evidence of certain things that are required to be a death in accordance with this chapter. And so that's another reason why that argument should be rejected. So I see I'm running out of time. I'd just like to briefly touch on the third issue, and that is the request for a mistrial. And on that point, I'd just like to say that in this particular case, there is no evidence at the time with respect to the incident that the defendant was being cross-examined about. There was no police interaction at that time. The defendant was not in custody. There was no interrogation. Therefore, there was nothing improper about the prosecutor's questioning. And even if there was a prompt curative instruction, and there was the strength of the evidence was strong. So given all of that, I ask that the court affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kolbe. Mr. Ishibashi.
Thank you. Excuse me. Regarding the notion that 327E13 is not related somehow to the penal code, well, the penal code talks about murder and different forms of death. 327C1, again, I want to stress, talks about the way in which death is determined. Under subsection B, it talks about the withdrawal of or the use of if a person is on life support, how do you determine? And they decided, well, brain death of the brain and including the brainstem. But that subsection section talks about artificial means of support. Now, when you go to 327E13, that is basically talking about the same thing, a death resulting from the withholding of, and that's how that subsection coincides with the section on death, and death coincides with the subsections in the murder statutes in the penal code.
Mr. Ishibashi, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you help me with your analysis that would suggest that if there was an error in this case, it requires the setting aside of the manslaughter conviction because of an error to not give an instruction based on 702.216. From your point of view, it requires a dismissal rather than a remand for a retrial?
Yes. And the reason why is because I'm basically challenging the cause of death. I mean overall, when we're talking about how this person died, cause of death is right in the middle of that in terms of my client not actually pulling the plug, but somebody else did. And then there's all these statutes which talk about that and explain that. So it's so, cause of death. So murder and manslaughter are cause of death kind of statutes.
Okay, I thought you were going to refer to 327E13. Is that essentially your argument under 327E13?
Right.
There can't be a charge, but that pertains to homicide.
Right. And so that has to do with cause of death, right? Cause of death means intentional, knowing, or recklessly causing death. Okay. So what the maximum he should have been charged with is perhaps creating the risk of death. That is, doing something which puts this person in a position that he could die. It's different from actually causing death. And that's one of the things that the argument pertains to. So other than that, there's a number of things, but I don't think I have time for that. And I thank the court for its indulgence.
Thank you to both of our counsel for your arguments.